From KPFK Pacifica Radio, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on Pacifica radio stations and affiliates nationwide. New cases of the coronavirus continue to be announced every day in the United States, even as President Donald Trump's administration downplays the risks of the disease. After initially asking for less than $3 billion in emergency funding to combat the spread of the virus, Trump signed an $8.3 billion package passed by Congress. But the president has shown a stunning ignorance of even the seasonal flu, insisting that Democrats were weaponizing news of COVID-19 to undermine his presidency and making unrealistic promises that a vaccine would be delivered within months to the American public. In late January, I spoke with Lawrence Gostin, a university professor at Georgetown University, about the coronavirus. Professor Gostin directs the O'Neill Institute for National and Global Health Law. He's also director of the World Health Organization Collaborating Center on National and Global Health Law, where he has served in numerous high-level capacities. And he co-chairs the Lancet Commission on Global Health Law and served on two global commissions to report on the lessons learned from the 2015 West Africa Ebola epidemic. Welcome back to the show, Professor Gostin.
Pleasure to be here. Thank you for having me.
So the last time, as I'd mentioned, that I talked to you was in late January. Much has happened through the month of February and into March. We're talking now about the disease spreading here in the U.S. before it was just something in China and South Korea. Are you worried under this administration that the U.S. is woefully unprepared from what you've seen so far coming out of the mouths of Trump officials and Trump himself?
Well, you know, we've got very key vulnerabilities. And, you know, let me start with the good part. The president has appointed a task force that has really great people on it. Fantastic public health servants, lifelong servants that are really excellent. I wish he had not asked Vice President Pence to lead that task force, because I think it should have been led from the science public health point of view. Vice President Pence does have a history of science denial in several ways. And I also wish that the White House would not have such poor messaging, you know, implying that it's not serious or questioning WHO's data. I think the public is getting nervous, fearful, and confused. But I'm really trying hard to be supportive as much as I can, because we're all in this together, and I want to make sure that we're really pulling together as a community. Having said that, I think there are key vulnerabilities that the United States does have, and they're quite serious.
What do you, just stepping back, though, because we've now had over a month and a half that the international community has been examining this with researchers, the world's best researchers looking at this, not just from the U.S., from China, from elsewhere. Do we know any more about this virus than we did in January?
We know a little bit more, but there are still a lot of things we don't know. I think we can be, you know, quite confident that this is a highly infectious virus. We've got many pieces of evidence to suggest that, particularly the rapid spread in congregate settings like hospitals, prisons, nursing homes, cruise ships. We see that it's almost a slingshot effect or an amplification effect, so that if you've got a lot of people huddled together, they're going to infect one another and they're going to infect a lot of people. So we know it's highly transmissible. We know it's person-to-person transmissible. We think that it can be transmitted by an asymptomatic carrier. We're struggling now to try to understand the fatality rate. We've seen data well below 1% all through, above 3%, 3.2, 3.4%, according to the latest WHO figures. I think the reason we don't know that is because a death rate is really, it's just algebra. We kind of know the numerator. That is, you know, when somebody dies, we can test them, see if they've had COVID-19 infection. But we don't know the denominator. We're only counting confirmed cases, whereas there's likely to be many, many more cases. I think there's a lot of silent community transmission all over the country, all over the world. And so my gut instinct is that we're going to see the case fatality rate drop to somewhere around 1%, maybe even less if we're fortunate. But remember, even if it did drop to 1% or more likely, say, 1.5%, 1.6%, which is what the NIH is predicting, we're still talking about magnitudes higher than seasonal flu, by 10 times, 15 times higher, maybe up to 20 times. And so when the president suggests that this is trivial, we don't have to worry about it, that it's just like the flu, I think he's misleading the public. We shouldn't panic, but we really do have to take this very seriously.
And it was quite frightening to realize that the president seemingly had no idea how many people the seasonal flu affects every year. Tens of thousands of people die from the flu. We're not just talking about infections, but die from the flu. And that's why, of course, we have physicians and doctors constantly reminding people to get their flu shots. The reason it's, you know, everywhere and constantly in public service announcements is because a lot of people get the seasonal flu and a lot of people die from it. But our president didn't seem to know that, and he was sort of shocked by it.
Yeah, it was really, I had to sit down when I heard the president say that, because it's pretty basic, and I think most Americans do know that a lot of people.
Well, especially if you're a political figure.
Yes, well, you're more than a political figure. You're the president of the United States of America, yeah. And you're there on a bully pulpit trying to inform the public. So it's not very comforting for the public when, you know, basic facts you don't know and you say you don't know them. I mean, we can forgive a lot of things. I mean, the point is this, that, you know, suppose we had a transmission even close to what we have during the average flu season, we would be expecting tens of thousands of deaths on top of flu deaths, so tens of thousands more.
Right, it's not as though the seasonal flu goes away.
And if it was, you know, and if it's got double the fatality rate, or five times or 10 times, you can imagine the impact on the United States and globally. So to kind of, you know, to understate it, I think does the public a disservice.
What about the development of a vaccine? Trump also seemed to not understand that the time it takes to develop a vaccine and then actually test it before it's safe for public use are two completely different things. And he was several times saying to the public that there would be a vaccine available within just a few months.
Yeah, I mean, that's clearly not true. The public health people on the task force quickly advised him otherwise. I mean, it will be about a year at least. And, you know, we don't even have, you know, a proven safe vaccine yet anyway. So, you know, maybe we'll never get one. I think we will. But again, you have to have realistic expectations. I think, you know, one of the things that the vice president asked all public health people to do is to clear health messages with the White House. I think that's exactly backwards. I think the White House should clear its health messaging with the scientists. And we should have one trusted scientist that honestly informs the public, that everyone will see and trust, that has integrity and knowledge, and that will tell the public what we know, what we don't know, and what we're trying to do to find out what we don't know. That's good health communication. We're not seeing that now.
Now, when we had last spoken to you, the disease was spreading very rapidly in China, in South Korea, and of course, many, many different countries, now Italy. But there are some reports suggesting that in China and in South Korea, the infection may have slowed down. Have you heard these? And if so, are they credible?
I've heard them and they're probably credible. I wasn't sure at the beginning, but I think we've had a long enough trend to suggest that they're credible. There'll be a variety of reasons for that. One is just containment methods. Both South Korea and China have used quite aggressive containment methods. But also, infectious diseases have natural ebbs and flows. And our big worry, of course, is that it might decrease, and particularly with the spring and the summer coming up, but then could come roaring back in the fall and the winter. So I don't. So it's certainly good news that we have reductions in those epicenters, but it's certainly nowhere near getting us out of the water. We're just beginning to see the cases rise throughout the world. And so while they'd be falling in some places, they're rising in others.
I'm wondering if we know anything more about how the infection spreads. There's a cruise ship off of the coast of California right now, as you and I are speaking, that was returning from Hawaii, and it's been quarantined while they await the results of the tests of several people who are ill. And it started because a man who had been on that ship a month ago had died from the disease this past Wednesday. Is it possible that the virus is living on surfaces much longer than we expect? I mean, the timeline sounds remarkable.
Yeah, I mean, we don't know. I mean, we know that it's spread through droplets. We know that droplets can infect surfaces and that people will touch those surfaces and then touch their eyes or nose or mouth, and that's how the virus enters. But we really don't know all of the epidemiology of this, so we don't know how long it will be on surfaces and things like that. But the Grand Princess cruise ship off the coast of California, I mean, we don't seem to have learned our lesson from the Princess Diamond cruise ship off Japan. It almost seems like, we're repeating a comedy of errors. And it just seems quite remarkable that we don't have a plan to keep the people who are on that ship safe. And keep the population of California safe. It really, and we don't even know who's in charge. Is it the White House? Is it the governor of California? Is it the CDC? It really is quite concerning that we don't, knowing that we have such a major risk on cruise ships, that we don't have a plan for how do we keep people safe and evacuated.
What would be lessons from the ship that was off of the coast of Japan and quarantined for a long time? Are you suggesting that maybe the cruise ship industry needs to have a moratorium till we know about this virus more?
Well, I mean, I think people are going to it's going to be a moratorium because people are just not going to take
Right.
cruises. But I don't know that we need to force that on the cruise ship industry, although I would regulate them to make sure that they had, good infection control and plans in place. But what we should do now, I think, to me, seems pretty self-evident. You want to protect the people on the ship and you want to protect the citizens of California. And so, people on the ship are huddled together. We saw this on Princess Diamond, and so they're probably cross-infecting one another. I would dock the ship right now. I would disembark all of the passengers. I would put them in medical facilities and carefully evaluate them,
So
test them.
separate each one of them.
You have to until you know. And so basically, once you've tested and you've observed their symptoms, there'll be some who will have infection. You need to medically isolate them. Some who will be knowingly exposed, and you need to quarantine them for 14 days. and some will be well, and you can let them go. But there's nothing you can, you can't do all that on the cruise ship. And so for every hour and day that we delay, we're putting more and more people at risk, and they're fearful. Their families are fearful. I've even been contacted by families of people on that ship, you know, who are dazed and confused. They don't know who to appeal to. The Secretary of State, Vice President Pence, the head of the CDC, the governor of California. I mean, it really, you know, unfortunately, it pains me to say it, but it is kind of a comedy of errors.
The Surgeon General of the U.S. Some days ago told people to stop buying masks. There are shortages of masks, and he basically suggested that it was important for only those people who are actually sick or suspect that they might be sick to have, you know, enough masks available for them. But if the general public starts buying them, there'll be less for them, you know, for those who actually need it, which could then end up helping spread the disease more. Does that sound advice?
Yes, of course it is. I mean, you know, we should not hoard essential medical equipment. And most people don't know how to use masks anyway, and so they're not very protective.
Right. There's only certain kinds of masks, the N95 masks, and they usually have to be fitted to a person's face, et cetera, right?
In order to be perfectly safe, yes.
What about stockpiling of other supplies? There are so many reports of store shelves being emptied of hand sanitizers, and just things like food and water and toilet paper.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, we shouldn't go crazy and we shouldn't be selfish. But we should be prepared. You know, I think it's, you know, it's fine for families to go out and make sure their fridge is well stocked and they've refill their prescriptions and things like that, and to have a reasonable amount of soap and water and sanitizer. But we shouldn't hoard, and we shouldn't, we have to think of our fellow person. I mean, the, you know, the remarkable thing about America is we're such rugged individualists that we forget that, you know, we don't have a, you know, total right ourselves. We also have a duty, duty to our families, our neighbors, our communities, our country. And that starts with looking after one another and not being selfish.
There is also a very strong case to be made for the weakness, the biggest weakness of the U.S. being our medical system, our healthcare system. We have 27.5 million uninsured Americans. Those who are insured, many of them feel that they might be underinsured. There's a lot of conversation around the cost of the testing. Governors of New York and California have ordered insurance companies to pick up the cost of coronavirus testing so as to not discourage Americans from getting in for testing. Do you worry that because we don't have a nationalized healthcare system like Canada or the UK, we're more vulnerable than some of these other countries?
It's one of our key vulnerabilities, undoubtedly. You know, we have the uninsured and the underinsured, but we also have undocumented immigrants.
Yeah.
And so if people are fearful about the cost of getting care, or they're fearful of being deported or having some other penalty, they're not going to come forward for testing and treatment. And if they don't, they're going to stay in their homes, they're going to go to work sick, particularly if there's no sick pay, and they're going to spread the infection to their families, neighbors, and community. It's bad for the uninsured person, and it's also bad for that person's family and neighbors and community. We need to have a robust social safety net, particularly in a time of a national health crisis.
Finally, do we know anything more about who's most vulnerable? It seems as though children aren't as vulnerable to this disease. The rate of infection among children has been quite low. And so far as I know, no deaths of children, and mostly it's older people in poor health.
Yeah, I mean, the children, I don't know that we know that they can't be infected, but what we're seeing is that children are don't seem to get serious illness or die.
They could be transmitting, though, right?
they might be transmitting, and we don't know that. I think we should assume it unless we find out otherwise. They won't be transmitting as much as a highly symptomatic person.
Right.
But yes, they could easily do that, and they can go into school and infect one another and then bring it home to their families. So that is a risk. But the main risk is to the elderly and then persons who have comorbidities, smokers, people with bronchitis, other respiratory diseases, cardiovascular disease, diabetes, people who are obese because of breathing problems. These are the people who are most vulnerable, and we see them also in, you know, vulnerable populations, you know, homeless, people who are homeless, people in mental hospitals, nursing homes, prisons. Those are the kinds of people we need to look after. And I've been saying, let's make sure that we're compassionate and we're thinking about other people. You know, visit your elderly neighbor, look after people, lobby your government to make sure that they protect the most vulnerable and that we have an equitable response. These are really important things in an epidemic. If we all come together and we look after one another, we'll come through this. But if we tears us apart, it's going to be a catastrophe.
Very briefly, I know you have to run, but there's a political conversation happening in this country around a Medicare for all system. Do you take a position on that at all?
Well, I've lived under universal health coverage systems in the UK, Canada, Australia, and other places. They're far superior than the one we have. You know, whether it's politically or economically or practically feasible, I don't know. If it were me, I would start with enhancing and buttressing the Affordable Care Act so that we can get to near, if not full, universal coverage.
Well, Professor Gostin, thank you so much for your time. Really appreciate everything you do.
Of course. Thank you very much for having me. Take care.
My guest has been Lawrence O. Gostin. He is a university professor at the Georgetown University, and he directs the O'Neill Institute for National and Global Health Law. He also co-chairs the Lancet Commission on Global Health Law. And we've been talking about the continuing spread of the coronavirus. I'm Sonali Kohatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter. Also follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at RU with Sonali.